I'm Anita Annabelle, and this is The Good Chat.
No, I'm not like compliments.
I'm quietly, I'm loving it.
I love making friends. I don't know what to tell you.
I'm a psychic. This podcast is going to be a
little chit chat.
This is probably the best chat. No, that's why this is called The Good Chat. We get good chat, mate.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Good Chat. I am your host, Anita Annabelle. I am so excited to bring this next guest to you. Kirsty Clements is a best-selling author, editor, journalist, and speaker. She served as editor-in-chief of Vogue Australia for 13 years and as a deputy editor at Harper's Bazaar. She is currently a contributor of The New Daily and has a brand new book out called Why Did I Buy That? We chatted about her role at Vogue, how the fashion industry has changed, how you can develop your own personal style and on a budget, and what it's like to be a woman at the top of her field. Here's Kirsty Clements. Thank you so much for coming on Good Chat today. It is such a coup for me. I have followed your career for so long. A little bit of background for anybody listening. I met you at R Media, which was Bauer at the time, when I was working there. And I remember Susanna, she introduced us, and I was a little bit starstruck, I have to say. Only because I'd watched you on Australia's Next Top Model, and that's where
I was very scary on Australia's Next Top Model.
You were very, very scary, but also so was Alex Perry. And when I met Alex Perry in real life, he is the best human alive.
That's true.
So you both have these personas, but you're not scary.
They manipulated us to look scary on the show.
They did. Oh wait, while you're saying that, did they really?
Well, yes, because really just in the editing. Because, you know, I think they didn't make me say anything particularly scary, but the way you can chop things up, the way you edit things as being an editor, you know, is what going to completely change the final product. And so when I saw it later on, and it's the music you put with people, you know, you're walking into a room, but it's like somber, like, and it's scared faces of the models and things like that, which, you know, in real time, you just walked into a room and said, hi, girls. You know?
Yeah, you were like, hi. But you were the Vogue editor-in-chief. So for those girls, you were literally the master of the universe.
Yes, I was scary to them, yeah.
You were scary to them and scary to the audience. So, but jokes on everybody, absolutely not scary in real life, the nicest person and also the most accomplished person. So before we get into everything about your career, you have just released a book called Why Did I Buy That? Which is such a question that everybody asks themselves. Yes. All the time. And I love also that it's something for us who want, it's for people who also want to look good in their 30s and beyond, and without becoming a slave to fashion. So talk to me about this book. Why this book now?
Well, the book is based on a series of columns that I write for The New Daily on Sundays. And the columns are very much woman to woman, like, how do we feel about fashion? You know, so really, you know, I've come from the very pointy end of fashion, from the very high end of the you know, international catwalks and design and designers and everything. But I know through talking to readers, but also talking to friends and colleagues and family, myself, endlessly, that we're still all really confused by it. And we get sent a lot of mixed messages. So we're targeted all the time with fashion, and yet we're told to buy less, and we're told to be more sustainable and think about climate change. But then, you know, new seasons, trends, and we get EDMs and updates every day with a million things to buy. And so I think people are very confused about, you know, how to put together a wardrobe that works for them. I think we get a lot of other messages too, psychologically and emotionally, about our size and our age and all that sort of stuff. And while body positivity and, you know, ageism is supposed to be, you know, on its way out, is it really? How do we really feel about ourselves? So they're just conversations with hopefully, you know, friendly conversations. It's certainly a very, I would hope, down-to-earth book. It's not the lofty part of fashion. It's the how do you make sense of it and how do you buy better? And so, you know, it's in the self-help section of Murdoch books. They put it in the sort of self-help category because in there I've got lists and things of how to create a good capsule wardrobe and how to buy less but better, how to just have more informed choices leading to the point where you feel more confident about yourself.
Yeah, the capsule one's really interesting to me because I'm not fashion forward at all, as they say in Project Runway. I'm a bit of a slave to consumerism. I buy fast fashion and it's something that I am changing. I just did a complete overhaul of my wardrobe. I got rid of 90% of
Fantastic.
My clothes.
Fantastic. And where did you
donating to, mm-hmm, to Vinnie's. Mm-hmm. So actually, I think I've sent it. I put it in Anglicare. It's the bins. So yeah, because I just feel like I have all of these clothes and I wore none of them. But the capsule thing is really interesting because for those who don't know, a capsule is just having a base wardrobe, mm-hmm, isn't it? And you basically chopping and changing. And while we're on that topic, I guess we may as well talk about it. How do you create a wonderful base or a capsule?
Yeah, and I mean, I didn't invent the capsule wardrobe, that's for sure. It's been around since I started in Vogue in the 1980s. Pretend I did, because I think I wrote stories about it in the 80s where you start with, and it hasn't moved very far, which is things like a great pair of tailored pants, you know, like black pants, maybe a black, you know, tuxedo suit, great white shirt, T-shirts that fit well, great pair of jeans, a trench coat, an all-purpose bag, a little black dress. But really, then, you know, these things can really be they're quite gorgeous when you think about it. And if you isolate it down to have the one perfect one. And a really important thing is fit. So make sure that it all fits you, that you buy the best quality that you can afford. Because I also don't want to be snobbish in this book about, oh, well, it's, you know, of course it's much better if you buy a $4,000 coat, because of course it is. But if you don't wear that coat, it isn't. But B, we can't all afford that. So, you know, I know people are shopping to the best of their budgets, but it's better to have one good thing than 10 bad things that don't last the distance. And it's hard for young women, I get it, because you want, you know, different things when you're going out. It's hard for any women. You want new things and, you know, you don't. So what you can do is have that sort of base capsule, and you might update that when it wears out with the new silhouette. Because, you know, there's always a new silhouette in jeans or, you know, but make sure they fit you. Don't just go for the silhouette. Like, yes. I skipped the mom jean for obvious reasons. Because, you know.
I think a lot of people
did. Come on. And I think, what is it now? It's a very wide-legged jean. And I think I actually think the flare at the bottom might be the same size as my thigh. So I'm not going there either. you know, so I know the jean shape that fits me better. But going back to your capsule, is if you've got these basics, then you can update them with something really fun. So you could put a new season shoe in there, or a fantastic new earring or necklace, or it could be a vintage beaded jacket that you found at the markets, or, you know, something like that. And you just update it. It doesn't mean you can't still have fun with it. And it's also about shopping your own wardrobe, is going in there and going, well, look, I've got this lavender shirt, which I put on today. Maybe that would look good with khaki pants rather than, you know, changing up colour combos, changing up, putting your florals with a stripe, you know, that you've worn them before in a different way. So kind of maybe getting a fashionable friend to come in and look at your wardrobe and go, why don't you mix that up? You know, why don't you wear that dress over that pant even? And shop your own wardrobe, and you probably find out that there's a lot of stuff in there that's got a lot more life in it.
Yeah, okay. And there's also, I mean, I, with Marie Kondo, when she was like, love, the rat, what doesn't spark love, joy, how love, good,
yeah,
how good.
I could watch,
honestly,
that on rotation.
That saved me. Mm. Me too. And that saved me because I, so many clothes, like, I'll put on, and especially like with weight loss, like I do, I'm a bit of a yo-yo dieter, but I've been losing a lot of weight recently, and those clothes that I used to wear when I didn't feel confident in myself, I was like, yeah, no, goodbye. They don't spark joy anymore.
They don't represent something to you anymore. I mean, I don't believe in keeping clothes in your wardrobe that don't fit you. You know, that idea that, if I lose weight, I'll get back into it. But you're yearning for a different person. And, you know, if you've put on a bit of weight, especially post-pandemic, oh, so what? You know, just, you know, really, like, just, you know, for a little while, just wear your leggings with a great little, like a linen blazer, or until, you know, you get back into your jeans. It'll come back.
Until you feel good.
It'll come back
exactly.
Once we all start getting around and getting back to sort of, if we do, the pace that where we were. So I definitely, you know, think, I know women are really hard on themselves. And sometimes I think the high fashion arena doesn't serve them well, you know, that they're always told to buy more and that to, you know, labels and very expensive pieces and, you know, certainly model size and things like that have big influence on how women feel about themselves. And I noticed once, I worked as a consultant for a brand and I worked in their store helping women choose things. It was a really interesting exercise. And every woman, and these were these lovely, accomplished, amazing middle-aged women who all thought they were at least two sizes bigger than they really were. They'd say, oh, I'm a size 16. I'd look at them and think, I don't think you are. And they were so underconfident about, you know, they were wearing garments that were sort of boxy and unflattering on themselves because they just didn't rate themselves.
See, that's the sad thing. And that's the scary thing about fashion, I think, is that when you don't have that confidence, you're more likely to wear. I mean, I used to wear so much black. I mean, don't get me wrong, I still wear so much black.
Same. Yeah, same.
You know, and it's because you feel more confident in black, or I feel more confident in black. But the last couple of weeks I've been like, oh, I can wear colour, I can wear white, I can wear, you know, whatever makes you confident. But you've got this passion for fashion. Oh, I just made that up. That was so nice. That rhymed. You've got this beautiful passion for fashion. Where did that come from? How did you get into this industry? Because you have had some of the most coveted roles in the industry.
I'm going to say that I don't have a passion for fashion as such. I have a passion for popular culture. So I don't, fashion's part of that. Because really fashion now more than ever is just part of the entertainment industry, really. It's just an extension of, which parameter bleeds into music, to media, to Netflix series, to fashion lines, to social media. So I was more interested in popular culture, in books, art, fashion, film, movies, theatre, punk, you know, the bands, the music scene in the late 70s, early 80s, like all of that stuff combined. And if you liked all that stuff, fashion, of course, would be part of it because you would comb all the old photographs, the Cecil Beaton photographs or the Helmut Newton photographs or whatever. So passion for me was a part of it. I had a passion for all of it, to be honest. And so I got the job at Vogue. I was working in a bookstore and I think I pretty much... it's a fantastic bookstore. It's closed now in the city that had all these great art books and fashion books and things. And I saw the job as receptionist for Vogue. I was 23 at the time. And I thought, oh, wouldn't that be a great way in the door? You know, wouldn't that, you could just sit there and have all these fabulous people walk past you. And so I applied and got the job as receptionist because that, you know, and they had such a thing in those days. And I was, I was only on the desk for about 6 months and I made myself useful. I would just say to someone, can I type up your notes? Can I pack a suitcase? Can I clean out the stocking drawer? Whatever it was, just made myself useful. And I knew I could write. My passion was writing.
Your passion is writing. Yeah, there
and
you go.
Then eventually the then associate editor, executive editor, I was kind of had a bit of a girl crush on her. She was really glamorous and amazing. And I said, oh, if you ever get an assistant, a budget for an assistant, could I be your assistant? And she ended up taking me off the desk and I became her assistant. And so I worked from the ground up. I did everything from reception to where I got to editor-in-chief. And it's, you know, I quickly found out what I was good at and what I wasn't good at. But if people ask me, well, what was the key to your success? It was that I would just always put my hand up and say, I'll give it a go. I might not do so well at it. You have to recognize that too, you know, grasp onto a job that you're not good at, but recognize the bits that you excel in and that sort of, you know, so I kind of went like that to the...
So how did you do that though? Like, how did you go from, you know, working your way up to getting editor in chief? I mean, Vogue is so, when you hear the word Vogue, it is the fashion magazine, mm. or it is the industry leader in that magazine.
Well, yes,
world.
Every business needs workers. And if you just put your hand up and say, "So yeah, it's all right, I'll do two jobs and then I'll go and take names at the parties at night too for the social pages. And then, yes, I'll be the assistant, but I'll also write the travel piece." Or they're like, "Oh, good, she's cheap, she's efficient.
Yeah, she's
she's doing three jobs."
And as we know in media, right? If you're cheap.
Well, not necessarily that I was a genius, but that I was capable and would do three things and not say, "Oh, no, that's not my area." And, you know, I suppose I knew, I looked into, I can't be a fashion director. I mean, she's amazing, but I can learn from her and watch her. But I can write. So I'll, you know, and so I went, I started in the promotions department. Then I used to do the men's supplements and I did everything. I chose the talent, you know, got all the clothes in, organized the shoot, did it all. And then moved to the beauty department, which I adored. I was the beauty director. And I loved that. I didn't even know such a job existed. And then, oh, my God, in those days. And then, well, probably in these days too. And then I moved to Paris. And I was a foreign correspondent in Paris. But that was very good in hindsight because it was small pond, big pond. And I got to go to the fashion shows. And so I could go to the couture and all that sort of stuff because they wouldn't have flown me from Australia. It was too expensive. And I was an assistant. Well, no, I was a beauty editor, but they wouldn't. The beauty companies would take you, but not the magazine. And so I got to just be up front. You know, I could do three things a day. And I know in one day I did a shoot with Tom Ford, who just launched his first Gucci collection, that velvet pantsuit collection, interviewed him and shot him. And this Diane Kruger was the model, who's now an actress. I interviewed Jacques Poles from Chanel in the afternoon, who's the nose of Chanel, and then I went to a Gianfranco Ferré book signing that night. And that's in one night in Paris. That's one day in Paris. So, you know, you didn't get those opportunities, nor do you still get those opportunities in Sydney. So I learned a lot on the ground in Paris. And then I was offered a job as deputy for Australian Vogue, so I came back and along with the...
Do you look at that point in your life and go, "What was my life?"
No.
Sometimes I go to things and I go, "Oh, those people are all on television and this is just normal for me."
No, because you weren't going home with them. You were going home to seventh floor walk up. And you're on the metro and it was raining and you couldn't afford another pair of ballet slippers. So I suppose I never really equated myself with the world that I was in. The world was my job. It wasn't like,
I'm high fashion.
Because a lot of that is they're just nice to you because you're doing
a story. Of course. But have you kept relationships with some of these people? Like anyone in those big in Paris or in Milan or
people I've kept relationships with people I was a junior with in Paris and we've all sort of risen up and grown and done our own things like David Mallet, he's very big. Probably the French hairdresser at the moment. He's an Aussie boy from Perth. And he and I were, you know, sent in these walk-ups doing the shoots, whatever shoots we could do, you know, trying to make a buck, schlepping around on the metro. So, but from the, you know, not really. Oh, yes and no. I mean, some of the people on the fashion circuit, you know, like Tim Blanks is that fantastic fashion critic who now works for the Business of Fashion. He was the head of style.com. Some, but... Once I left Mags, I kind of moved my life moved away from that.
Yeah. Moment. I mean, it's one of those industries, I guess, that moves so quickly. And, you know, even I look back and you left editor-in-chief after 13 years. What year was that again?
2012.
Yes. I mean, look, it's almost 10 years ago. Yeah. And so that's like a whole other world to you probably.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. So, yeah, you've got to remember some of that world is fake. And I'm not saying in that in a negative way. It's just what it is. It's just so high, marvelous. No, they're not. You look at the tribulations that people go through in fashion, you know, and that wonderful Alexander McQueen documentary and everything, and how lonely it could be for someone like that at the top. So you can't mix up the idea that we always used to say, you know, the minute you don't have this role, the people will change the number in the speed dial. Like, you've got to.
It's true, you know, though. Even working as a freelancer, and you would know this, and I think you might, and I might have actually spoken about this before, but even now that I'm a freelancer, you kind of see people who, they don't need you anymore. And the people that I used to kind of work with on a regular basis, like weekly, daily, if I can't get them a story in a big online website, they don't need me. And
it's all part of the hustle.
Exactly. And by the way, for anyone listening, it is very glamorous. It still is very glamorous, but there is that real, every job that we have in this world is, there's positives and negatives.
Well, it's a job. I mean, I think it was the most thing was clear to me once. I was going to the Chanel Couture show in the Ritz in Paris. Okay, now I know that sounds incredible, but but it was gorgeous. Of course, it was gorgeous. But I'm rushing on the metro. I had twins at the time. I remember it was raining. You know, I was just dripping wet. You know, trying to get there. This is pre-digital phones, and so. You know, and I got there, and I got there late. It's really unheard of for me because I'm in Aries. I never get anywhere late. And I got there late, and the show started. They wouldn't let me in, and I was just like hyperventilating because if you didn't see the show and write the review and fax it to your editor, then it didn't happen. You know, there wasn't anything to, you couldn't ask someone to see the photos on the mobile phone or whatever, and so I was like, oh my god, it's the Chanel Couture show, and I've missed it. And then the lovely PR, I think she saw that I was going to literally have a heart attack. And she said, you can come to the next show, which is the clients. Right. So I waited, and there I am with my dripping umbrella and my wet shoes and everything, sat next to this woman, dripping in diamonds, lots of plastic surgery, you know, head to toe in Chanel. And she's like, oh, hello, you know, and I was like, oh, hi. You know, she said, you know, we just started chatting, and I said to her, oh, I'm a journalist from Australia and I missed the show, but they've let me come to the client show. And she said, oh, where do you work? And I said, oh, I work for Vogue. She went, oh, that must be lovely. It gives you something to do, doesn't it? And I thought, there you go. There's the difference between the client and the worker. I said, something to do.
You're like, I literally have twins. Wait, yeah, I've got to go home on the train in the rain.
See the twins, file the story, which will be late because I've got to the second show. You know, you've got to remember there are different worlds that are colliding in the show.
But I feel that you, particularly as the role of editor in chief at Vogue, I actually feel like you were there in its heyday. That's I believe that it's kind of now not. I mean,
It's massively
it's
different.
So different. What are the massively key changes different. You think? Because I truly do believe. I mean, I grew up I'm a 90s kid, so I grew up with magazines. Yeah. I actually grew up with TV hits, not Vogue, but it's still the same thing. It's like that was the heyday. It was like the magazines. You would buy a magazine and it would be this glossy, beautiful thing, and that's what you look forward to. Now it's so quick and fast, and it's just not the coveted role, I feel. Am I wrong in saying that?
No. I mean, it's such a big conversation in it, but essentially the digital age changed it. And so once, you know, digital came in and magazines were slow to adapt and work out how to monetize that, the economic base fell out of magazines. And once you started chipping away at that, you were chipping away at staff, chipping away at budgets, you let the advertiser take control, you know, then you started to ruin the actual product. And then increasingly the consumer was, he or she could get it in different places. They were much more in control of what they wanted to see. You know, they could go to niches on Facebook at that, you know, before it became, you know, over to Instagram and TikTok, what have you. But they, you know, it just completely and utterly splintered, you know, the audience, and they were they entered the room. They were much more in control of where they saw it and how they saw it and what they consumed. So the role of the editor explaining it to you anymore disappeared. You didn't really care anymore. And so because we were in a very privileged position where it was only us that were seeing it. You know, we were invited. We told you 6 months later. I was in the Ritz in the little gold chair, and I told you 6 months later. But once you had a camera phone, all bets were off. So But the expertise in magazines is still there. You know, some valiant people still doing it. And, you know, I think the digital, you know, iterations of Vogue around the world are really, you know, they're trying as hard as they can, but it's an economic issue. And now after pandemics, what about the show system? Does that need to exist? People flying around the world on carbon points? Like, everything's evolved, you know, but that elitism is also out, you know, and we were elite. I read a really interesting article in the New Yorker about teen magazines, though, because, you know, magazines like Dolly and things like that were really important to young women. Like, we really loved them, you know, Dolly Doctor and all that sort of stuff. And they've all kind of fell by the wayside because of, you know, lots of advertising and what have you. And now all the kids are getting their information on TikTok or, you know, where YouTube, wherever they're getting it from. And they're like, there was this really lovely era of, like, say, 12-year-olds being talked to by women who are about 14 to 16 years older. They were giving them really good information, and they're not really getting the same information from their peers. So I would predict a bit of a rise in teen magazines, to be honest, of that guiding force. Yeah, but in terms of fashion, it's yet to be seen, isn't it? But I think the globalization of it will mean that we're going to see more coming from lots of different countries, which I think will be more exciting. And
that is exciting.
Like a much more edited, curated version.
One thing that I loved about what you said about the passion for fashion, it being more about pop culture, was that my sister and I have this interesting argument, I guess you could say, and she's always like, when there's a red carpet, ask them something else other than what they're wearing. Mm. And I actually say to her, but no, Lulu, like, it's actually the designer's time as well.
Yes.
This is actually, understand why they're asking them, because this is actually a designer's chance to shine. It's their chance to style some of the most, you know, influential people in this world.
Oh, it's some of the best publicity they'll ever get.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so I always say, you know, I get it. I get that we want to ask them deeper questions. I mean, you're never going to ask it. You and I know this, when we've worked on red carpets, we've been on red carpets. You're never going to ask get the full deep conversation out of somebody on a red carpet. But there's
you'd be shot by the publicist.
Exactly. Oh, yeah.
Don't get it deep and meaningful when you do an interview with them.
Exactly. That's so true. That's why I choose my talent.
And they won't say anything. That, you know, it's like you can go back over celebrity interviews over, you know, I won't name names, but you're just like, you haven't said anything.
You haven't said anything.
Very elegantly said nothing for 20 years.
Yeah.
No, that's not the place to do it. It is the place to... I think it was Robin Wright or something. She was really funny. She just knew that was the gig, you know, and she'd go up and go, this is this and this is this, and then she'd spin around and she'd just do it, because she was just like, that was the exchange. That's the economic exchange. So, yeah, it's there's so many ways to find your fashion now, you know. I mean, I'm still a person who finds it on the runways. I like to look at the shows and go, oh, look at the colours that are coming through, or look at the new bags or what have you. But increasingly, and you know, magazines used to explain that to women, but I think I also think magazines lost their way, not from the staff that were necessarily doing the management. Not go there.
One of my best friends is the beauty editor at some of the biggest magazines in the country, and she lives a life. Like, it is absolutely amazing. But she works really hard and hustles and is so incredible at what she does.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm hoping that there's like a resurgence of being able to pick up a copy of something and really that become your monthly thing that you do.
I mean, whether it's physical or whether
it's on the iPad.
We've got to learn to pay for things.
I agree.
Because the problem is, you know, I still have to explain it to very smart friends as to why you need to pay for a subscription to something or to pay for a proper masthead. I mean, I teach in college sometimes and it's like, there won't be any real news if you don't pay for it. You know, people have to be supported. You know, they won't, you know, you've got to sign up for proper news. Don't just get your news from Facebook. Get your news from you know, proper mastheads, and like, you know, a New York Times or a Guardian or what have you, or, you know, and if you do like a magazine or somebody who's really putting out great products, support them financially.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, you can't have everything. You'll end up with nothing.
It's so true. Do you know this one thing that I, every time I see you, all I can think of is The Devil Wears Prada. And I know that I'm not saying that you're the devil who wears Prada.
No.
But I honestly want to know, is that what it's like? Was that what it was like in that industry?
No. Now, I don't know that you can compare American Vogue to Australian Vogue. You know, I mean,
why is that?
Well, it was a super powerful, super successful company. She has a huge amount of power in the fashion industry.
Anna Wintour, yeah.
Yeah, sure. So I don't think they're really comparable, you know, a bit apples and oranges. But
that's really,
I mean, definitely the same advertising pressures and the same, you know, she had the book that she had to do and the party where she had to remember everybody's names. There were some parallels. There weren't things, you know, like you can't go into the fashion cupboard and take whatever you want. That's nonsense. None of that stuff is free.
That is not, that is so true.
You don't get to take it all out and give it to your friends, you know. I mean, and I don't, you can't really treat people like that. You know, you can't throw your desk and things up. I mean, no. I mean, it was a hyper realistic idea.
Of course.
But I thought Meryl put some real empathy in it because
she
was
movie.
A bit lonely and trying to hold on to a job and everything. But yeah, it had some glimmers of reality about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it did. Yeah. I was rewatching Sex and the City. I mean, I'm rewatching the whole series because I know the new one's coming.
The new one's coming. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I kind of missed a lot of the first one because I think I was very deep in the midst of my editorship. But it got a pretty good grip on magazines and fame and all that sort of stuff in that period.
Oh, interesting.
You know?
I'm going to have to watch that to see.
It holds up. Yeah, it holds up. Definitely.
I always
does.
Forget that Carrie had a column.
Yeah, and she goes to work at Vogue for a while. And
oh, she does too.
Yeah. Yeah, she says she gets $4.50 a word, which is unheard of. But
absolutely not. It's media.
Now you'd be working for free, I'd say. Yeah. But,
you'll be like,
imagine,
so would you like a story? Here's a
imagine
story.
If you got $4.50 a word. Oh,
that
God.
Would be, I think you and I would be the richest people in the entire world.
Yeah, no wonder she had all those Manolos.
I know.
Yeah.
It was that show as well. I'm so excited for that to have a resurgence. I think I'm excited for the older generation, I guess, to see themselves represented on screen.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not really, you know, they're not a very realistic representation, but their trials and tribulations probably will be. And I think that's really exciting because it was really, I guess, in that heyday, it was for young people. It was really coming up in the ranks of and that's...
Yeah,
and
that mid-30s, you know, wanting to have a baby and all that, that very tricky period.
Yeah.
It does hold up. I thought it would be really old-fashioned and it actually isn't, strangely.
Oh, cool. I'm going to have to rewatch it and report back.
Yeah, I've enjoyed it.
And you...
Lockdown, you know, relief.
Yeah, of course. Mm. And also with the new one coming, you got to. Mm. So you were on top, like you were really the big boss. And like I said, from someone from the outside looking at you being a woman on top, that is such an insanely inspiring thing to be. But then you were juggling twins. So you have twin sons. So you were juggling a family and life. How did you juggle those things back then when it wasn't like that, like it is now, I guess?
Well, I think it's still hard. I mean, luckily my husband wanted to be a home husband, house husband. So he stayed home with them until he even kept them back. You know, they fall mid between the school year, 5 and 6, and he kept them back the extra year because he just wanted them at home, which was pretty cute. But I was really lucky to have that, you know, so I didn't have that terrible wrench that I see, you know, where the baby's a bit sick and they, you know, can you drop them off at daycare and, you know, can you go home early and all that sort of stuff. So I was really lucky to have that. I had a lot of help, like at-home support. And then I think we had occasional babysitter, but we never really had to have a nanny or anything like that. We just that allowed me to travel and to do all that sort of stuff. And I sort of really had that policy at work because most of the people I employed were women. I was like, I never want you to knock on my door and say, can I go home early or my baby's sick or whatever. I don't even want you to bother yourself about telling me. You just do what you need to do. I know you'll do your work. And, you know, I always found that the working mothers worked, you know, incredibly hard. There wasn't, you know, oh, do I just like to stay home with baby? They were doubly, you know. It was one of those things where I was just like, please don't ever ask me, just go if you need to, because it's really important that we accommodate all that. I think the new generation are going to be better about that. I mean, you can see workplaces are better about everything, about mental health and bullying and, you know, yeah. Oh, completely. I mean, there's going to be a big shift. I mean, a lot of people don't even want to work anymore.
I literally am working I'm 35 and I'm working 3 days a week. Not ideal for money, everybody.
I just bought a new book. So it was like, why we need to stop. We need to re-look at what we think work is.
I know, because it's the amount of pressure that we put on ourselves, especially in media. And I think that's one thing that people don't realize. When you work in the media, we are go, 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 go. And especially now digital media, we work 24/7. I mean, I'm an entertainment journalist, so I was always working around the reality TV cycles. That is exhausting. The burnout is so real. Mm. And I think people, you know, everybody works really hard in their industries, but that kind of industry is really unforgiving.
Yes, and I think, I mean, the ups and downs of the pandemic have really, like, making people really relook at their life choices. And, you know, it's like, you can't tell people for 4 months to stay home and then on the Monday go, everything's okay now.
Okay, come back.
You know, we're altered somehow, and we're probably our vision of how we want to live is probably altered. It might snap back, it might change completely. I don't know. It's all exploration, isn't it? But I mean, that's what happened to me after I left Vogue. I remember thinking, oh well, I'll go back to corporate. I'll get a big job, and you know, go and make lots of money. And then, but I had to write my book. And then, as I started to stay out of it, I was like, oh, I don't want to do that. And then, I don't think I want to go back to those corporate meetings. And then after a while, I think I got PTSD. First time I had to do a meeting with an overhead light or some people around the table, I was like, oh no. And I just increasingly just became, you know, I'm just a freelance creative now, because I don't want that corporate cut and thrust. You know,
no.
I had it, I did it. It was, I could do it, and I don't want to do it anymore.
And you saw, and that's the other thing, I guess, that people think of your job as editor-in-chief. They see you being the glamorous head of a magazine, but it's not that at all. It's budgets and staffing and costing and, you know.
Oh, you're always in trouble. You're always in trouble. I went back to Harper's Bazaar a couple of years ago as the features director for a couple of days. That's where I met you.
That's where I met you, yeah.
This is a great gig. You know, this is half, you know, 2.5 days a week and, you know, lovely editor, lovely team and travel and da-da-da.
That was a great team.
And yeah. I remember saying to the editor, you know, she's like, you know, all the dramas. I said to her, I was in trouble, like, every half an hour. Like, you know, I had to solve
for
something.
What?
Oh, clients, advertisers, management, you know, like, just constant. You were... It does look glamorous, and of course there are very glamorous parts to it, but you're very under the microscope. It's a very visible role.
Yes, of course.
And a lot of people, you know, a lot of people are quite invested in taking you down.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Because traditionally, these big companies that we've worked for, they're all run by men.
Mm.
Is that fair to say?
Yes and no. No, because when some of the best people I worked with were women, and some of the worst people I worked with were women as well. And same for men. So no, I can't really pinpoint a gender.
Yeah,
no.
Okay.
No,
because I just thought that the ownership of these big magazines were men.
Ownership normally, but in managerial roles.
Right, they were women.
Oh, often, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Often in the advertising side and, you know, no, I couldn't, because I had a stream of management, like lots of different managing directors, both male and female, and, you know, I couldn't pinpoint you to that the men were more. No, not really. And, you know, my teams were predominantly women that I would hire, women and gay men, I guess. yeah. But I don't know that the... I can't talk for other industries. I haven't been in them. I don't know about whether the gender divide was greater in media. But ultimately, if it's privately owned or whatever, normally you would find it and it was owned by,
And that's, and I guess, you know, so when you left Vogue, what did you feel like you lost a part of your identity, or what was it like leaving those doors and going, I'm no longer Vogue editor-in-chief?
Yeah, it had, because I'd been there for almost 3 decades and it was abrupt. I did have to sort of go, where do I go in the morning? You know, because it was just this kind of, you'd go and I'd sit with a cup of tea with my deputy and my a PA and we would talk about what the day ahead, and it was just such a routine. And I'd just done it for such a long time that I was a bit shell-shocked. But I got a book deal like the next day. So and luckily I had something immediately, because you get people, because what are you going to do now? As if you would know 12 hours later after you've just been retrenched what you're going to do. And so I had a minute to sort of sit and think and write, you know, and I'd get myself up, go to a friend's house and go and write this book for like 6 hours a day, and got myself into that mindset of being a journalist again. By the time I came out the other side of being a journalist, I think that's where I was at the point where I'm like, oh, I would quite like this, you know, not being accountable to anybody else, just only to myself. But I did have to rediscover myself, certainly. Even things like, what music do I like? What clothes do I like to wear if I don't have to go anywhere? What do I like to eat? Because before it was all restaurants and appointments and dinners and you know, it was like, what do I do in my downtime even, you know? But at that point I had, my kids were just about to do their HSC and my mum was really, really ill. So I kind of turned my head to family and, yeah, but I think it took me about, I'm going to say, a couple of years to actually get that hard skin, like that hard shell that I developed off, and go, who am I? What do I like? Where do I want to go on holidays if I'm choosing it? Not taking a holiday because I'm somewhere, you know, but.
It's almost because they were picking, being what you were, they chose what you had to be and what you had to do. That's so interesting.
It was like, I don't know how many choices there were in my life until I finished, you know. It was lovely. I'm not saying that job was, you know, poor me, not at all.
But
it was just, it was a way of being. In fact, my friend took me the next, about that week afterwards, because that was all press and people being assholes. And so he said, let's just go to Paris. Here's some points. He transferred me some Qantas points and we went to Paris. And I literally, it's in my book, and I just got to Paris and I just like bought a khaki parka from Zara and just was like, and jeans, and was like, I'm just a 50-year-old woman in Paris doing my own thing. I'm not going to the Chanel show. And it was really good. That's what I really started to go, what would I actually do here in Paris? You know, me, what do I want to do? Yeah. I don't have to rush to an appointment. What do I like?
You can see the sights. You can go get a croissant. Yeah. You can go get a croissant.
You can just sit somewhere for 4.5 hours if you felt like. It's really good. Exactly. And, of course, as a city the last 10 years, the more you do that, the more you absolutely cannot go back.
Of course. And you probably won't. I mean, when you were retrenched, and I don't really remember this only because I think my age and maybe I wasn't in that industry at the time. What was that like for your self-esteem, and how did that happen?
It was a change of management. So that, I mean, that was something I was always up against, was you were constantly getting a change of management. This was a change of management at head office, and then a change of management of our CEOs. And so, I didn't really have anybody backing me anymore. So, you know, I guess she wanted to make a big statement and put a new editor in, and, you know, this is the beginning of a whole new thing, whatever. It happens, you know, that's what happens. But if anybody in a role, if it shifts up the top, it's going to shift down the bottom. You've just got to accept that that's going to happen. So by that time, I think that was my seventh manager or something like that. So I was like, I don't really have anything to prove to you. So, you know, this is the decision you've made. But I did have to say to myself, and I honestly didn't take it as a blow to my self-esteem in terms of that I couldn't do the job. I didn't take it like that. I just took it as it's change. It's a regime change. You know, so you have to accept that. So I just kind of had to do some work on myself, and I think that relates back to what I was just saying to you about going, well, then who am I, and then what do I like to do? Not, oh, I better go and rush out and get a job.
Get something straight away.
I can prove something to you. It was like, oh, actually, all right, then that's moved on. You know, who am I? And I guess writing that, the Vogue factor, helped me get to that spot. But no, I didn't, like, weirdly enough, I didn't take it personally. I took it as more of a regime change, because all of it's got swept out, all my team
as
well.
Of course, everyone was out.
It was ridiculous.
But how do you deal with that upheaval in the media. So obviously we work in the media, but then the media is our biggest
and then
critic.
They turn on then they turn on
and well, they turn really, on you.
I don't think they were seeing that I was the beginning of a whole bunch of look at it now.
This is and what it, I'm saying. You were in the heyday. This is why I keep saying this. And I know you and I have had a conversation previously about, you know, the younger generation coming in and working with you. And I always say, I just don't understand how they cannot see who you were. And I know that you don't think of it like that. I do. But it's, to me, you paved the way for all of these other people.
Yeah, but they're doing it in a different way. You know, there isn't it, they don't. Their disciplines are different, and their you know, the way they produce content is different. The way they take information is different. I was obviously very unhappy for my team to be swept out because, you know, they were really talented, and you know, some of them were at the beginning of the careers or their mid careers, and so I was a bit. I'm like, well, I don't know where they're going to go because increase after that, it all started to steamroll, and there's, as you know, now barely a magazine standing. It's, you know. So it was the beginning. It was the crest of a wave that was just about to crash. But I don't, and you know, and you got the papers were all like, ha ha ha. But little did they know it was all coming down the tubes for them later on as well. But you know, it's always they make fun of other people that lose their jobs, and when it happens to them, it's like, oh dear, my God, you know.
It's such an unforgiving industry, honestly.
Yeah, the media.
But we love it.
They eat their own.
We're sitting here bitching about it like we don't like it, but we do.
They eat their own, but.
We actually really do love this. I love my job. I love everything that I get to do.
I loved every second. I loved not every second, but most of Vogue until the day that I did, you know, that I was not there anymore. But I did feel there were other editors that also. Since then, I mean, so many. And then I'm just like, where did all that talent go? You know, that was when they closed recently, Elle and Bazaar, you know, and it was just like, where does that talent apply itself? But also who's going to tell these people's stories? Well, you're doing it on your podcast, which is great. But it is about that, you know, where are these stories that we used to champion and position people? Where are they going to go? So that was probably more, you know, there's a poignancy about that. But then you can't get too nostalgic because other things pop up.
Yeah.
You know?
And I think that's one thing that's why I've created my own platform to be able to tell people's stories, because I think in the jobs that I've had, which I've absolutely loved and had the best time, you have like an interview with someone for 15 minutes and you just cannot get the story that it's not even about getting content or getting a story. It's just like, I am genuinely interested in people's stories. I'm genuinely interested in how, you know, you went to Paris and you got to go to a Chanel show, but it really wasn't as glamorous as you think it is, you know, like I'm interested in that. And I think a lot of people out there now, we are starting to kind of, I can feel the tide turning. I feel like that fast news knowledge, people want to consume better. They want to consume more knowledge. They want to consume and learn.
Yeah. Yes, I think so. And I do think, you know, people are starting is like swing away from expertise. You know, it has this anti-expert ideology that's, you know, like a bit like with, you know, particularly saw in America, and you know, it's this don't ask the experts, they're anti Dr. Fauci. You know, it's like, what on earth is that? You know, where has that sprung from? Where you've done your own research. But I think this is a very tricky time for people, and I think, you know, to navigate also what's out there and to try and find the truths that resonate with you and experts. And, you know, you also, I think this generation, they've sort of been encouraged to know a little bit about everything, and that's fine, but it's really, really important to know a lot about something, I think, because you need to, and I do say that to these kids in college, it's like, you know, it's all very well to be an influencer, but maybe you need to stand for something specific. So that someone goes, well, I need an influence. This person's a very, very knowledgeable about X, you know, rather than just scattergun what everybody else is doing. So I think that's what happened with magazines when you know, the budgets got cut and then everything just kind of looked the same. It was like, you know, you really got to make something precious to get people's attention and time and money.
I remember reading a magazine in front of my uncle. It was a Cosmo. I was probably 14 years old. And I remember my uncle going, Anita, look at that story and see who wrote it. And I'm like, yeah. And it was like so-and-so. And then he said, okay, turn the page and look at that story and see who wrote it. Same person, totally different topic.
Terrible.
And that's the thing is that, and look, I, in my job, I've had to write about things that I have never, ever, ever, ever spoken about before. I've had to like Google to get the information. And I think that's
no good. That's terrible.
And that's what's, that's what the industry has turned into. But at the same time, I guess there is, you know, so much need for that fast information. And my you know, like I said, my best friend who's the beauty editor, she is Elise, she is unbelievable at her job. She is so knowledgeable. She always helps me. We're always constantly, you know, talking about products and all of that kind of thing. And she's like a rare breed because she's a real special, she specializes in what she does. But everybody kind of underneath those editor positions, you're trained to kind of write today lifestyle, write about entertainment, write about the Kardashians, but then write about this coffee machine.
Well, yes. And that's not necessarily a bad thing because that's just training and technique, you know, like so you can work across disciplines. So it's like, well, you can write about the Kardashians today and flyaway hairs tomorrow and dinner, and you can do some clip. But that's not necessarily a bad thing, I don't think, because that's just, you know, the more you write, the better you are at writing. But then ultimately there should be something you really specialize in, because at the end of the day, it's not just the writing, it's ideas, you know. And you have a blank slate every morning, especially if you're a digital editor of something, you've got to write an EDM and you need four topics. And you literally have got to go, you know, it's not just the writing, which is a skill in and of itself, but to actually go, well, you know, there's a story because of Carrie's dress from Sex and the City, how this person, you know, sells lipstick on TikTok, how, you know, it's ideas. That's where you get the burnout as well, you know. So I think I have a lot of admiration for the churn and burn of, you know, because I read those ones that come out of American Vogue in the morning and the writing is so good, and I think you just got that done in an hour.
Vanity Fair as well have really brilliant stories.
Airmail. But that where they just, and it's like, you know, it's like this is what we're wearing, you know, pumpkin coloured spice nails for fall or whatever. And you think, oh God. But then when you read it, you can't, you've done a really good job.
You have done a phenomenal job. And you definitely, just for the record, everybody, anyone who works in digital, my hat's off to you because we work bloody hard. You know, I think my record in a day was 11 stories I churned out. And that's 300 plus word stories. And we're talking like giving that information and you're churning and like you really are. And you've got to also have that skill to be able to write quickly, write well, and, you know, engage the audience.
So it hasn't been dumbed down. It's just that
it's
been accelerated. Yeah,
absolutely.
And I worry for that burnout, you know, that was, when you talk about what's different from magazines, I had a team of like 18 people, you know, now you have maybe four or five on a magazine, you know. And so we could really think over things and really think them through. Maybe we contemplated our navels a little bit too much. I don't think so. But actually it was quite, you think about it, we didn't have all the digital technology to make things go fast. You know, we didn't have, you know, models came on go-sees with books under their arms. You know, it wasn't like you just flipped some pictures. I mean, it was really very, very labour intensive, sort of hands-on work, to be honest. There I am at the show sketching, you know, and in a notebook, with a, you know, a pencil. It's not, it's, it was different.
It's just now it's like getting that phone out and just taking the photos, stick it up. They're sticking it through there. I went to my first fashion show actually this year. I went to the Afterpay fashion show. And the one with the controversy of the paper. But I was in awe. I was like, oh, this is amazing. Because I've never, ever been at a fashion show before.
Yeah, they're beautiful.
And they're beautiful. And, you know, the thing that was incredible for me was, and I've said this on this podcast before, was that I was sitting opposite Camilla Franks. You watching her watch her own show and you're just like, this is not a world that I'm, to us, it's like this most magical thing. But, yeah, it is, it's always kind of to be seen or to have the phone out or to do it through that lens, I guess. But there is a need for all of this fast
Well, yes, I mean, it's when we used to go to Australian Fashion Week, we hadn't seen those clothes. We were literally looking at the clothes, evaluating them, putting them in, editing them, staying up and having pizza till 3 a.m. in the morning, looking through the film, trying to get a magazine out. And now it is more about the actual real-time virtual streaming show itself than it is about the clothes. They're quite often an afterthought, and I don't know, there's not many even journalists left in Australia who could evaluate a collection. Not really. I mean, they'll go, I liked the blue dress, but they won't be able to tell you the history of, you know, it's only a few, a handful.
There's that funny
but people want that information, maybe not.
There's that funny scene in Devil Wears Prada, going back to when they go cerulean blue.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yes, it's true, but I don't know that people really care anymore. You know,
if it looks hot on Instagram, then that's what they care about. Yeah.
If they don't like that blue, then they're not going to, who cares? So, but that's great because that means they're empowered to make their own choices.
What has been your biggest blessing in your life?
Blessing? Probably good health. You know, I've been blessed to have good health. And then I think just to be surrounded by so many lovely friends of all different ages and friends and family, and just have so many lovely, lovely people around me. But isn't that, I do think health, and maybe it's because I'm getting older, darling, but you do sort of go, you're really lucky if you, you know, been able to achieve what you've achieved because you're able and to, you know, we should take stock of that. We should be, you know, we should be thankful for that, that we get to, you know, enjoy that. And then so, but probably, yeah, and then just, you know, great mother and beautiful kids and, you know, friends and family and everybody, just like, I'm lucky for that.
So lucky.
Yeah.
It just goes to show that having a really high-powered job that people look at and think so glamorous, what really matters is your family and your health and your life and your quality of life.
You couldn't do the other one with, and then when that finishes, which they do, you have to have the internal life and the support system to fall back on, because they're jobs, you know. They're like, you've got a title at somewhere. You're not it. You're not the masthead. You've got the business card, but somebody else's name might be on that. You've got to remind yourself of that, I think.
And what advice do you have for people who want a career in fashion, do you think, or that industry?
I think it is still, you know, a very valid career, but going back to our original point in the discussion, that you need to educate yourself about everything. So you can't just know fashion. That just, you know, you end up sounding like someone who just likes shopping. It can sound a bit shallow. You need to know about film and art and books and sport. And so you've got references. So if you see something, you say, oh, I see what they're getting at. You know, that's Steve McQueen or, you know, Fassbinder or, you know, Kubrick or Anais Nin or Diaghilev. You need to have references for when you're looking at something, not just go, oh, lovely dress, because that's the difference between, you know, influencing and being a proper journalist, you know. So
I'm excited to see how the world changes in this kind of industry. I think it's because it rapidly changes so quickly. It'll be interesting to see who's ruling the world in the next year.
Yeah, I like when you looked at the Met Ball recently, I was like, okay, you know, I needed a couple of days to download that in my own head.
What did you think of Kim Kardashian's black t-shirt?
I don't know.
Thing.
I have no idea. It's nice not to see her for a minute, but I just the cloak, like what, I was like, okay, not what I would have thought celebrating American design.
Yeah, that's the thing that cracks me up is not, the theme.
Okay, and you've got a horse's outfit on and but I get what it was with the YouTubers and the TikTokers and, you know, because it's just about reach and filling up the internet for a couple of days. So I just had to download it for a while because I think it's really important, as you see, as fashion is always about change. You, you can't be critical of change. It's ridiculous. You've got to look at it, evaluate it, put it in context, you know, see why it is important socially, what part of it is it playing in history. You can't just go, I don't get it. You've got to go, okay, you know, not as I was expecting, but let's have a look and break that down. You know, that's the fun bit about fashion. It's the social significance of it.
I have learned so much because someone who is not, I don't find myself very fashionable, but I feel like I now know how to dress for my body. I think it's only something that I've really come to terms with as a in my mid-30s, and I now know how to dress for my body and for my confidence and how to, and that's something that I think comes over time. And I think that is something that I'm excited about your book, because I think a lot of people will realize that just because you're not 25 years old, it doesn't mean you can't enjoy fashion and you can't enjoy fast fashion, or you can't enjoy, you know, fashion from the runway.
No.
You should be able to continuously move forward and evolve. And it's all about feeling confident in your own skin, in my opinion.
Yeah, definitely. And that can come at any time too. You might not have it. I mean, I think I probably became more confident about my body after I had children.
Yeah.
Because I was like, you know, it functioned, you know, you're like, good on me. I had twins. Like, you know, I don't care if I don't have a particularly flat stomach. I never had one, and I don't really care now because I had twins. So I was kind of easier on myself later on. I guess it was that thing too. I don't know how I did not compare myself to models and things like that. You know, I always just thought, well, I'm a journalist and you're a model and you look great, but I don't need to look like you. I think it's a grey area. It's a tricky area for people wanting to emulate someone rather than admiring someone, you know, and I think that's hard on Instagram. You know, I think it's difficult for those younger girls. There's just so many people they could be looking at, and I wish I looked like her. I wish my body looked like that. You can't tell with the, you know, it's like magazines, but like times 1,000 million, you know, it's a tricky area. I think, I hope the next generation, they start to turn away from it a bit and try and just live their lives in the present, you know.
Well, this has honestly been, this has literally been a really good chat.
It has.
I know. You're thinking you and I could just talk, right? I know. I looked down at the clock and I was like, this has been an hour. Thank you so much for coming on the Good
Thank
Chat.
You.
I am so thrilled to even know you and to almost, you know, to be able to talk about these things with you. And I think you make it really easy to talk about something that I know nothing about, and I think that that's something that, you know, is quite commendable, and honestly, thank you.
Thanks for having me on. It's been
You're
really
welcome.
Fun.
I know it has. All right, we'll see you soon.
Okay,
bye. Well, that was such a good chat. On next week's episode, I have the utmost fortune of speaking to Jason Arrow, who plays Alexander Hamilton in the Australian cast of Hamilton. And I cannot wait for you to hear it. And if you like this chat, you can rate, follow, and review, and follow me on Instagram at AnitaAnnabelle_ and at The Good Chat Pod. See you next week.